for every £1 Britain puts into AI, America puts in $24, maybe £24. So why is the UK still the third in the world? And is that even sustainable? I'm actually joined by Daryl Mann here on Influential Visions podcast. 30 years studying how systems innovate under constraint. He's an ex-Rolls-Royce chief engineer, and he's been in innovation for a long time. And we asked the question, the headlines won't. Can Britain actually pull this off? And I'm quite excited about this. This is a huge conversation. We're not going to dig into anything too technical. And it's interesting. The UK just put 500 million into a sovereign AI unit. 28 billion is pledged into 5 AI growth zones, with 68 billion total pledged since January 2025. Big numbers, right? But 5 US companies will spend 700 billion on AI infrastructure next year alone. Yeah, sniper or a slingshot? You know, it's a big one, right? We got so much here. You know, leveraging 500 million versus 700 billion is it kind of wishful thinking, or do you think it's a sort of pressure of innovation under constraints, Daryl?
It's a really good question. I'll start. I mean, you mentioned my innovation background. We've spent obviously the last 30 years studying how money gets spent on innovation. And so our definition of innovation is getting a successful outcome. So did I create a product or a service that made money? I got a positive return on investment from it. And the staggering and consistent finding from all that research is basically 98% of money spent on R&D delivers no value. In other words, it doesn't deliver the outcomes that you were aiming for. So in that sense, the gross amount of money that's been spent and the numbers you're talking about, enormous numbers, even if you just look at the UK one, then all of our research says is, well, it's going to be a tiny fraction of that actual spend that's going to deliver value. So in that sense, I'm not so worried about the UK's potential in this regard, because I think one of the things that's lack of resources has done in the UK is force people to think harder about how you're going to spend that money. And so, if you look at, well, of course, DeepMind and AlphaFold, UK-based organizations that are really at the forefront of the AI technology world, I mean, they've worked miracles because they've thought hard about the problem before they've had the opportunity to go and spend millions, billions of dollars developing solutions. So I think there's that side of things. And I'm cautiously optimistic that that ability in the UK to break rules and find ways of using resource very, very effectively is a potential. Having said that, I think, as you said, the primary race globally seems to be between the US and China at the moment. And I think what China's doing that the US isn't doing is it's combining that UK resource intensity and creative thinking with big budgets. And so I think if I had to put my money on who's going to be the most successful in this domain, if you say, okay, well, they've got an enormous budget and they're spending it really, really well, it's China versus America. And certainly from an innovation perspective, what's happening in China is essentially state-driven drive for innovation because there's been a historical lack of respect for intellectual property. Then the only way that companies can continue playing in the game is they have to be continually innovating. I mean, you only have to look at automotive right now and what's coming out of China versus every other OEM on the planet. And if you take that and apply to AI and particularly the problem of compute, because your data centers and who owns the hardware increasingly becomes a big issue with this, then I think China's showing the way in some respects.
Interesting. So obviously, I mean, There's been a bit of news recently when it comes to using space for storing data in satellites and also obviously potentially further afield, right? And the cost reduction that comes with that will be absolutely huge for the US in particular, well, for private companies, right, in the US. So we don't really have a sort of way of competing with that, right? So China potentially could. So we have to innovate. We have to innovate, otherwise we're going to be stagnant, right? And this is the problem. But obviously we've got so many potential areas that we can actually use AI. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff when it comes to medical, when it comes to analyzing what's going on in the NHS and stuff like that. Do you think that we're sort of making some good moves in that kind of area?
I think the UK is, I think there are pockets of that. And I have to say that from personal experience, as well as what I can see around me, the government is acting as something of an anchor to it. So I think there's lots of brain power in the country that wants to do great things. I think there's been a track record that government has tried to support things, usually underfunding things to try and create that sense of resourcefulness, but it's really lacking at the present time. So, I mean, to give you a personal example, we've got a pilot study from the Welsh government, so within the UK, and it's a AI-based project that's effectively enormous ambition. Let's build a digital twin of Wales, such that politicians, researchers, businesses can make better decisions about infrastructure in the country. So enormous ambition. Great that they funded it. We just come into the end of the feasibility study, which has demonstrated, this is completely doable. You've got to think smart, because Wales is a fraction of the UK, very limited budget. But it's a classic case, I think, also of someone somewhere solved your problem. So there's an awful lot of really smart thinking when it comes to AI, and particularly systems, that we can take advantage of. Now, having said that, we're looking for phase two money, and we've been told for pretty much all of this year thus far that, nothing's going to happen until the election takes place, because we don't know whether it will be the same people in power at the end, and if new people come in, then they may have a completely different view on things. So literally nothing's happened in terms of funding for things. So I think the UK is very prone to these kind of political effects, and nobody's really sure where the right place to spend money is. And for me, of course, the huge irony is that the whole purpose of this project is to help build a capability to decide what are the best places to spend the money. And we can't get that through, because I think there's a lack of understanding at the government level. Because overwhelmingly, I think government officials in the UK tend to be lawyers, economists. And there's another contrast with China right now. I mean, the reason that China is able to get so much stuff done is because they've got engineers in charge. Now, that's not to say engineers are any better or any worse than economists or lawyers, but when you've got engineers in charge, one thing that will definitely happen is stuff will get done. In many ways, the other job of the accountants, the lawyers, the economists is to stop stuff from getting done. And there's certainly an element of that in government in the UK right now. So it's all of the AI projects that we're either involved in directly or we're tracking. It's people, individuals who've seen a problem that AI forms a potentially great solution for, who are fighting for resource to make a dent in the problem. So I think that, the will is there. I think the capability is there, and the government infrastructure that's necessary, I think, to form the crucible and get these things started, that's the lacking part right now. So in theory, that's an easy problem to solve. And you mentioned the sovereign funds and things like that, which are intended to do that. But if we wait around for a year to iron out and work through all the political issues, then that money is just going to be spent on bureaucrats administering changes in policy, and that's not going to go well for anybody.
Well, you said a lot there, and I mean, I've seen that there are some things that are actually happening. One video I watched said that they had implemented AI within 1,000 people within the government, and actually it didn't really help them to deliver their jobs much faster or better, yeah. Perhaps a little bit better in terms of the emails, which made me smile. So it's just ridiculous. I mean, I wonder who on earth is actually implementing these things. Clearly it's not you, Daryl, otherwise it would be working, right? I would think. So it really is, you know, interesting. I mean, they're trying to run planning documents so that they are processed in 2 minutes, right? Which is rolling out apparently this spring. 1/3 of chest x-rays is now AI enabled. Fraud detection, 80% faster. Apparently 500 million saved across public services. I don't know about that. That's a figure that I've found here. So I don't know. What do you think on those before I dig into the next load of facts that I've managed to find?
Again, I think there are pockets of success. I mean, one of the problems in the whole AI industry right now is there is so much hype around because those companies that have invested are rapidly reaching the point where they need to start demonstrating to their investors that there's something in this, that's a return in it. So it's sometimes very difficult to plan your way through that hype. We try and do that. I mean, you know, if you're in the innovation business, you need to be in the reality business. You need to understand what's actually going on rather than what people are saying is going on. So I think that there are some, again, pockets of success. I mean, you mentioned some of the healthcare situations where I think...
But it's not new, Daryl. I mean, like I knew of a chap doing an AI project with Oracle, and it's got to be 5 years ago when I spoke to the guy. Probably did a podcast with him, maybe 6 years ago, and he was doing something with regards to some sort of vein treatments and stuff like that. I forget exactly what it was, to be honest, but he pioneered this, and it amazes me that they're still that far behind, considering that he did this pilot study and it worked, and reduced deaths, right? It shocks me to the core, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, we see it all the time in the innovation world, in that, again, there's a beautiful example of a smart individual seeing a problem, found a solution to it, and hits then the chasm, as it's usually called, of I've proved that I can make this solution, but now I need to scale the solution. I need to turn it from the experiment into the money-making machine and the value generating machine. And that's where government funding is at its weakest in the UK, but also I'd say many other countries as well. But it is that chasm that's often talked about of I need the money to scale this thing now. And you end up with a lot of frustrated prospective innovators like the person you've just described there. I think China's demonstrated that follow through and that that government support to the point where this thing is generating value. Because I think the foresight that China's bringing is that if we're the first to crack this particular problem, then we can sell it to the rest of the world and generate revenue from it. So they see it as a much longer term investment. So one that we can see is, again, let's go to healthcare. And there's been an awful lot of talk about radiographers, for example. And there was a view, let's say 3-4 years ago, that that already then AI was better at examining X-rays and identifying cancerous cells. Yeah, so therefore, we don't need radiographers anymore. Yeah, that was completely the wrong way of looking at things. So what you can see in China now, to some extent, the US is a recognition that says, hold on a minute, the bottleneck on taking X-rays has now been eliminated. So therefore, we can do more X-rays. So we can serve patients better. We can, the cost doesn't need to go up because AI is doing a lot of this stuff. So we still need radiographers and we can actually employ more radiographers because there's more cases, more X-rays that can be taken and analyzed. And speaking as a patient, I think I'd rather get my results from an X-ray from a human than I would from an AI. Right. Yeah, so actually, if you think about it the right way, then AI becomes a collaborator with the radiographer, the human. The human does the EQ parts and all the complexity bits that the AI can't do. And then you've found something which is heading towards actual innovation, where you serve the customer better, you make money from it, and literally everybody wins. But it needs that mindset that recognizes the chasm, first of all, and has got a plan for how you get from proven prototype through to, this is now a business that serves every part of the ecosystem.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, China are doing, you're right, they're doing some incredibly interesting things. And I think we will become purchasers of what they have. I mean, if you can walk into a train station and walk into a cubicle that is in effect a doctor that will analyze you, and then it will give you a prescription immediately that you can walk out with, right? That's what they're doing in China, right? And it's like, how far behind are we, right? We're actually quite a long way behind that, you know, really.
I think so.
Despite the fact that we've got all these amazing people at Oxford, at Cambridge, all these universities, right? We are sitting quite far back, right?
In my
opinion. You know, and people, I mean, I was watching a video earlier, like people think, you know, the rest of the world can catch up with America. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not convinced of that. If I'm perfectly honest, I think yes, they can catch up on some capabilities. They can reduce costs, right, by having their own hosting, their own AI models, and this and that. But at the end of the day, infrastructure is what it is. You know, once it goes to space, then we've got an interesting challenge, haven't we, over the next 10 years, which are going to be interesting.
I think so. I mean, to give you a data point, one of our clients in the US has just laid off 30,000 people because they need to invest $150 billion, I think it is, in data centers. Now, on the one hand, you say, okay, well, that's a pretty brave decision, and it sends a signal to the rest of the world that, okay, so it's all about compute, and we need to allocate enormous amounts of money to do that. I'm sure China's got the money, but what China said is, well, this idea of getting into space and just taking today's data center and just building more of those. Well, that's where your $150 billion comes from. Yeah, here's the cost of a data center today. And so if I want 10 more of them, then I need to find 10 times the budget that I took on the first one. Whereas what China's saying is, look, it says you need to find more effective ways of doing things. So you look at the heat generated from a data center, for example, and say, wow, that's an incredible amount of waste energy you've thrown away there, which is why the whole space debate comes into the equation in the first place, because you lose a lot of those losses providing you get to space. China says, well, there must be other ways of using that waste energy such that your cost of building the data center, your cost of operating the data center comes down massively. So you can see, for example, underwater data centers where you can use existing resources and therefore get a far more efficient overall system in terms of its ongoing energy use. That feels to me like a pragmatic way of looking at the innovation challenge. I mean, on the one hand, you've got to say, okay, well, I love that American ambition that says, we'll just put us all in space. That's the kind of guy that Elon Musk is, of course. But I think China's, I'm sure, watching that, but is saying, if you look at the amount of waste in the current way of doing things, it's madness committing $150 billion to building the same as what you've already got. We need to innovate and find ways to use a lot less energy and make the cost come down. And I think that's the route they're taking. And by all accounts, as far as we can see, are doing extremely well.
Interesting. So potentially it could be a way of heating and cooling our homes, right? Once that innovation has sort of kicked off.
Exactly,
assist people with that, right?
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's another element to this, of course, which is that if you say, okay, well, what is the actual data that's going into these data centers? And the answer you come back with is the vast majority of all that data that's being processed is noise. Yeah. And so it's like 99.9% of the data that's being processed is literally noise. And so another innovation approach, which I think, here's where the UK could Mark, play the game, I think very effectively says, okay, well, there's no point training, building an LLM with noise in it. Yeah, why don't we take out all the noise and build an LLM that's just got signal in it? Yeah, let's distill the world down to what are the core principles on which everything else emerges. Now you need a data center that's dealing with an awful lot less data, but is going to deliver you a much more meaningful solution in terms of the advice it's going to give people, the data, the knowledge that's going to come out of using such an AI.
So it's more sort of, it's going down the route of kind of perhaps having a device on-device AI as well, and actually splitting up the models that potentially work with each other, right? So, for example, I'll give you an example, right? I downloaded a model to my phone the other day. Like, there's this new Google model. You download it straight to your phone. Okay, it's 2 gigabytes or whatever it is. But actually, it works on your device. So it could be there's like an edge device, which is your phone or your computer. And then there is a data center close to you, which has a different model. And then there is a bigger model that sits somewhere else, and then they all interact with each other, right? Is that the kind of thing that you're sort of talking about?
There's certainly an element of that, yes. So localization of things. But I mean, to give you some kind of context, so we've got relatively speaking, very limited resources to build the agents that we're building at the moment. But our ambition is things like, a digital twin for Wales. So the way we've been tackling that is to say, so if I distill the world down to these core principles, just how does society work, then what you find is that, I've written a number of books over the years, and you could say, the whole innovation story is in 20 books. We're trying to write a book of first principles now, and that's effectively the information that goes into the agent that we're building. Now that book is probably 100. Well, at the moment, it's looking like about 100 pages. Yeah, okay. So you can distill things down, to core principles. Which, as soon as you get to that level, then that's an app that you could put on anybody's phone. You could put it into somebody's hearing aid. It's an enormous condensation and distillation of information down to everything comes from this. I mean, again, it's someone somewhere solved your problem. If you think about it, and you hear Elon Musk talking in interviews, one of the things that he absolutely insists on with all of his engineers is that you understand the problem at a first principle level. And to some extent, I think that's working for him. But I think he's got another agenda in terms of data centers in space. I think he's seen, I've already got the technology for a lot of that because I've built Starlink. So how can I further monetize that? That's not really first principle thinking at that point. I think that getting to Starlink in the first place demonstrates a lot of first principle thinking. What I'm saying is there's so much noise in all the data that's around us. I mean, just think about what's on your hard drive at the moment in terms of actual knowledge. I mean, your hard drive, anybody's hard drive, then the enormous majority of that is literally valueless data that we've
got. Speak for them, Daryl. Don't speak for my hard drive.
I'll make it my hard drive then. I mean,
not your hard drive either. Most people's hard drives. Let's say that, shall we?
Absolutely. I mean, just all the holiday photos. I mean, on one level, those holiday photos are very meaningful. But now we can take things digitally. We take 30 photographs of something, and 29 of those photographs are never going to be looked at again. But they're not going to be deleted either.
True. Well, that opens up sort of opportunities, doesn't it, for businesses to sort through all of this, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're sort of edging towards.
Yeah, it's very easy to build bigger and bigger LLMs, but you reach a point very quickly where all you're adding is just more noise. Yeah, it's I mean, all right. Of our research on innovation over the years has said For example, there are millions of ways of solving problems badly, and there are a very small number of ways of doing it well. So we've had past discussions about 40 invented principles. There's only 40 invented principles. So as soon as you know that, you can say, okay, well, all those millions of failed solutions, then I don't need to put those in my LLM. I just need to code into my LLM these 40 invented principles. And what I've now done is given the AI and the human that uses the AI an enormous shortcut that says, okay, when we've encountered a problem, use one or a combination of these 40 strategies, and that's going to give the answer that is going to fix the problem.
Interesting. I mean, I think in terms of sort of infrastructure and stuff like that, there's a lot of interesting stuff that's sort of going on, right, in the UK. However, I think when it comes to the government and what's going on in the government, the turmoil that is actually existing there, there's civil unrest, right? We can dress it up all you want, but there is mass civil unrest.
Yeah.
And actually, we don't really know what the government is using AI for in that regard. I think that they've probably been doing some sort of modeling. They've probably been doing some predictive modeling around what will happen if this happens, what will happen if the police behave in this way, crowd control, all sorts of these things have clearly been modeled, right? I know we've got leading cybersecurity elements over there in terms of AI. I've heard about that, which is amazing, right? It's amazing. But the problem is that we've got a general, I think it's an apathy. I think, and that apathy is caused by a lot of people are quite depressed with the current situation. They hear on the media a lot of stuff, which is just ridiculous. You know, apparently 47 out of 100 people, 6 out of 10 on the public sector AI adoption index score 2026 score 47 out of 100. But I mean, I think, I wonder what that 100 means, in fact, right? Who is deciding what 100 actually means on the AI adoption list? And also, fewer than 2 in 5 civil servants describe AI as empowering. I mean, look, I'm not surprised, right? They've probably been in those jobs for 30 years, 20 years, and I'm not knocking the civil servants, but I do think that they have no idea of what it's like to work for themselves. They have no idea, actually. And that's why they're just dragging their heels. We're in a scenario where the people that drag their heels or don't have extra value to offer are just by the wayside, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's certainly a tough one. I think we see more commercial enterprise struggling with AI adoption than we see government. I completely agree with your words as far as what I can imagine happening in government, because we've done projects with government over the years. We've done projects with GCHQ in the UK, for example. Mm-hmm. So I know, incredibly smart people, but having enormous IQ without direction is pretty good way of creating all sorts of unintended consequences, which are not good. Yeah, and I think what's missing with all of the organizations that are struggling with AI adoption at the moment, and I'm sure more so with government, is if we don't have a clear direction, then what's the AI for? What do we want people to be doing with the AI? Then all we're seeing is more generation of noise, unfortunately. And I think that understanding of direction, what is this for? So in the US, I think I can see an awful lot, particularly with our clients there, predominantly in commercial world again, although we still do quite a lot of work with the education sector, where AI right now is being seen as replacement of humans. I've been describing that as that's not innovation, that's managed decline. If that's the direction that companies are taking, then it's a pretty short road to catastrophe. Companies that will go out of business, governments that will just create more and more inertia and find it even more difficult to get stuff done. So that can't be the direction. In other words, yeah, AI as a replacement for human makes no sense at all because of the things that the AI fundamentally can't do that the human can do. So, I mean, my hope for the UK is that I think one of the bulldog skills historically of the UK has been when the crisis gets bad enough, then clarity of direction and vision and mission become the uniting force. And I don't think we've quite got there yet. As you say, yeah, lots of civil unrest. I think we've gone from a government which was just wholesale corrupt to one that's now completely ineffective. And I think the population is saying, you know, looking at the ballot papers and saying, I've got no idea who to vote for here. There's nobody with any sense of direction at all until that direction appears. And it needs to be a direction that the population can say, okay, that's it. That's the thing I'm voting for. Right. Then we are going to struggle. And I'd say I continue to be hopeful, but if I look at the political world right now, it's difficult to see where that hope comes from in the UK. I say starting from who's got direction, who knows what we're trying to do here.
I absolutely agree with that. It's between a rock and a hard place, right, in terms of the way it's going. And
I think
But 56% of public sector IT staff say AI has made their jobs more demanding and not less. And that, for me, is a culture alarm bell, right?
Yeah.
It is probably, in my opinion, I think it is a badly managed solution as far as I'm concerned. And 90%, apparently, report fragmented systems across departments, which is also, that's just... I mean, it does not surprise me at all because there are all these legacy old systems that are just, got all this data and there's no clear plan, probably multiple vendors locked in over X amount of years. And it's probably just stuck, right? As far as I'm concerned. And that's why all these initiatives are stuck in pilot mode, as well as the political turmoil that you've alluded to here, which is well, if we don't know who's going to be in charge, then how are we going to commit to a 7-year spend with a vendor that could actually make a good change? And the problem is we're not thinking long term. And that's why the Chinese are in good stead, because they think in 100-year terms, right? Look at the Great Wall of China. I mean, it says it all. I mean, how many years did it take to build it? I mean, hundreds of years, right? So I think short-termism must, have a long-term strategy at its core. And until we get to that, we're stuck, aren't we?
Yeah. I work with a lot of Chinese organizations that they've all got at least a 50-year plan, and most of them have got 150-year plan. And they look at the West and they look at businesses with basically determined by quarterly figures, and look at governments with 4 or 5 year election cycles, and they rub their hands with glee and say, there's no way that you can compete with the long-term vision that we've got. So I think there's some things that just have to be depoliticized. Yeah. So, and I think in the UK, that vividly needs to happen. Yeah. Because you see so much oscillation in terms of education policy, healthcare policy, et cetera. And all of that toing and froing, just undoing what the previous party did, is literally noise again.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, because it's like, it's like a sort of confirmation why they exist. It's been going on for decades, right? It's like we go into government or we go into a new job. Okay, we're going to go local. And then it's like, no, we're going to go wider. We're going to go nationwide. No, we're going to go global. And it's like, hold on a minute. Like, why are you changing something that works already really well? And it's people just underestimate. I mean, Michael Tobin, CBE, he said this to me once. He said, people overestimate what can be done in 1 year and they underestimate what can be done in 10 years, right? And this is so on point. It's so true. So last sort of question, I think, here, right? So why does this country keep producing world-class plans and middle-of-the-pack execution? I think that's a is that something you can solve, or is it a structural feature of how Westminster works? I hate to ask you this question, but you've sort of alluded to a bit of it. But I thought I'd just wrap that up for the last question here.
So here's, I mean, it's very easy to be pessimistic in the UK. So why on earth am I optimistic?
Yeah.
So I think that historically has been a culture in the UK of accepting the slightly odd person, the inventor in the garden shed that occasionally comes up with something which is world beating. So my digital twin for Wales, someone somewhere solved your problem. So cybernetics starts in the UK. Okay. So that idea of systems thinking starts in the UK. And my digital twin is just building on that knowledge. I didn't have to invent stuff. But I take that on board, saying, okay, that Stafford Beer and Ashby and those people that originated this stuff weren't listened to by government officials. It was all too difficult. And the irony in all that, of course, is what they were trying to say was, look, you need to understand systems. If we could understand systems, then from a political perspective, we'd understand how to connect the dots between things and why it was crucial to do that. So now the new dilemma becomes, okay, well, so it's all about systems. If we understand systems, maverick person that sits in the garden shed and reinvents cancer care, whatever it might be, has now got a way to turn that seed of an idea into reality. Okay, so it's all about systems. So I would, if I could, say you cannot be a politician in this country unless you've passed an exam to say you understand systems. Now, I know that's pretty naive on my perspective, but part of my digital twin plan says, okay, well, I can't expect politicians to understand systems, but what I can do is to give them a tool, an agent that sits on their shoulder whispering wise words in their ears that is prompting them to ask questions which force us to understand what systems are. So I think it's a classic model in terms of you can't expect everyone to re-educate themselves. People are, in many respects, immutable, and people that tend to go into politics and governments perhaps more so. You need skin in the game with these things, but how do you get the knowledge into people? Then I think the answer is, the slow answer is they go through an education system that gives them the requisite knowledge. That's going to take a generation to fix. How do you do it in the short term? You provide people with an AI that has got that knowledge embedded in it. So when they ask a question of the AI says, well, yes, I don't think that's the right question. How about you think about it like this? And you basically coach the person to ask the right sort of questions. And once that happens, then we're well on the way to giving the inventors and the engineers a mechanism to turn ideas into reality.
That's clever, because it can go both ways, right? The knowledge will flow both directions. So, if you collate all the questions and all the problems, I think that could be a really incredible part of the solution, really, couldn't it? I mean, it could be huge.
Again, Daryl, in very naive mode, I ran out a specification for a minimum viable politician, a minimum viable government worker, and what would be the way forward? And I think the first step in that way forward would be to say, okay, so we're going to set up a political party that's very much just a temporary transitional thing. You're going to vote for us, and we're going to have a national referendum in the next 12 months where we're going to sort out what is the direction of this country? What do we want as a society? Once we've got that, then a lot of other things fall into place much more easily. Again, it's back to the someone somewhere sold you from China. If you've got a long-term vision, then it's much easier to align people into knowing how they fit into that story. Instead of having people cancelling each other out, then we know what the direction is. That's where we're going.
Makes sense. Thanks, Daryl. It's been very interesting. I look forward to releasing this episode.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.